listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bernie's on the road tomorrow, so today we're having a special Thursday edition of Brunch with Bernie. Get your calls ready at 866-987-THOM. Senator Sanders, greetings.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. I heard from your office that you may have to leave for a vote at some point during this hour.
No, the vote just took place, so we're in pretty good shape.
Oh, great. Okay, super. So what's going on? What's on your mind? Tell us about the vote. Tell us what are the issues on your part.
Well, we have just, with this vote, I think, ended the session before the August break. So I think it's a good time to kind of recapitulate in terms of what's been going on in Congress and in the country in the last few months, and what are the issues that we're going to have to focus on when we return in September. And I think the major issue, Tom, is overwhelmingly the state of the economy. Deficit, to my mind, is an important issue. We have cut the deficit in half from $1.4 trillion a year down to less than $700 billion. We have more to do, but we have made some significant gains in dealing with the deficit. But the crisis that remains in this country now is very, very high unemployment. While we have, of course, made progress in the last 5 years since the Wall Street fiasco and losing 700,000 jobs a month, I want everybody to understand that real unemployment today, not the official unemployment, but real unemployment, including those who have given up looking for work, and those people who are working part-time, remains at over 14%. Youth unemployment over 20%. Black youth unemployment over 40%. So anybody who thinks that we are in a good place in terms of employment is absolutely wrong. But it's not just the large numbers of people who are unemployed. The other issue that we should be focusing on, Tom, is the kind of income that people are receiving. A job is not necessarily a job. And what we have seen in recent years is the loss of decent-paying jobs and the replacement of jobs that are, by and large, low-wage jobs. Most of the new jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs. So if you take somebody who, say, just with a high school degree, 30, 40 years ago, that person could go out, get a job in a factory. If he or she had a union behind them, you could actually make a living wage. Those days are gone. And the jobs now are open, that are open for those folks, are Walmart, Burger King, McDonald's, Popeye, et cetera, jobs that pay $7.25, $8, $9 an hour, not a living wage. So the first issue is, how do we create the millions of jobs that we desperately need? Second issue is, how do we raise wages in America? Some of the listeners may have noticed that around the country, in a number of cities, workers, including a lot of young workers, are taking a one-day strike. They're walking off their jobs at fast food restaurants. And what they are saying loudly and clearly is they cannot make it on $7.25 or $8 an hour, which is what many of them are being paid. And I really salute the courage of those young workers to stand up not only for themselves, but for millions and millions of other low-wage workers. So one of the issues that we are working on that I hope to see come to the floor as soon as possible is a minimum wage bill that will raise the minimum wage to at least $10.10 an hour. The truth of the matter is that today, in terms of real dollars, in terms of purchasing power, minimum wage is paying about 30% less than it paid in 1968. So the minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation. We have more and more people working at low-wage jobs. If we raise the minimum wage to, say, $10 an hour, it will mean a wage increase for some 30 million workers. That is not just those folks who are making $7.25 an hour. They'll go up, obviously, but people who are making $8 or $9 an hour will also be bumped up. And despite the mythology out there, most of the folks earning these low wages are not kids. They're working people trying desperately to keep their families together on horrendously low wages. Just do the arithmetic, 7.25, 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, you're making $15,000. And nobody can live on $15,000. So raising the minimum wage is an issue that is of significant is of great significance to this country, and I hope we'll all stand with those low-wage workers and fight to do that. The other day, Tom, I had a press conference with John Conyers, Keith Ellison in the House, talking about single payer. And right now, I think everybody is focused on the implementation of Obamacare, and I voted for that. I think it has some very good features in it. But at the end of the day, we've got to go beyond Obamacare. What we have got to establish as a principle in the United States of America, that health care is a right, R-I-G-H-T, for every man, woman, and child in this country. After Obamacare, depending on how many states end up coming into the program, we will still have many, many millions of Americans with no health insurance. You'll have many more who have high deductibles and high copayments. So Obamacare may be a step forward, but we have got to move toward a single-payer health care system which guarantees health care to all, and that's what the press conference was about. The advantages of single-payer is that it eliminates a lot of the administrative waste in the current system. Medicare, which is a single-payer system by and large, is administered far more cost-effectively, much less administrative costs than private insurance programs. So what we have to do is, A, guarantee health care to all, do it in a cost-effective way, and the way to do that is through a single-payer system, eliminate, get rid of the private insurance companies whose only function in life is to make as much money as they possibly can. We got to lower the cost of prescription drugs, which in America for brand-name drugs are now the most expensive in the world, and that is an issue that has got to remain on the agenda. Let me mention some interesting news, and I think good news. Earlier in the week, I was at an event with the Veterans Administration. I'm chair of the Senate Veterans Committee. Mm-hmm. And they had a wonderful display of new technology, which VA healthcare is doing. VA healthcare is the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States of America. It provides healthcare today to some 6 million veterans in this country. And by and large, it has its share of problems, but by and large, it does a pretty good job. And most of the veterans that I speak to in Vermont and around the country are pretty happy with the care that they're getting. What this meeting was about that VA held was to display some of their new technology in telehealth. And telehealth is a radical new concept that I think is going to have profound changes in healthcare throughout the country. What it means for a start, that if you're living in a rural area, you can get on the phone and talk to a teleconference and speak to your psychologist, your psychiatrist, and you can do it in some cases in the comfort of your home, or maybe you're going to go to what's called a primary health care facility in your town rather than having to travel 100, 150 miles to get to your appointment. What we're seeing is also, in terms of telehealth, the ability of specialists at the VA to actually diagnose problems when people have cameras in their homes. So imagine having the camera on your foot looking at a problem being diagnosed by a doctor 1,000 miles away. It saves money, it provides increased access to the veterans, and better health care. So very impressive what the VA is doing there. One of the issues that I am working on is chairman of the VA, and we can talk about that in a moment.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. A day early today, because Bernie's traveling tomorrow. So give us a shout. We'll put you on with the senator right after this. It's 15 minutes past the hour. And don't forget, Bernie's website is sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can also download the free Tom Hartman app over at the App Store. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a day early. It's Bernie's traveling on Friday, so today is Thursday, and Bernie is taking your calls right now. And Bernie, you're here with us?
I am right here.
Okay. James in Belvedere, Illinois. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator Sanders. I think you're great. You too, Tom. I think we need a initiative for jobs through a Buy American program that gives, that returns tax dollars back to people that are still making earned income. They're not retired. They're not disabled. They're still, so it's paid for. $2,000-$3,000 they can tie it with their own savings, tie it with a bank loan for products that are manufactured, produced, and sold retail in this country that brings appreciable value back to their property. So they're raising real equity levels of their home to spend in other sectors of the economy, and they're creating jobs for people that don't even have homes.
Well, James, you touch on a major issue, and there are different ways to tackle the problem. I think the issue that James is referring to is the fact that fewer and fewer of the products that we purchase are manufactured in the United States of America. And in fact, we have lost some 60,000 factories in the last 10 years in this country and millions of decent paying jobs. And how you turn that around, I think there are various ways of going at it. James has suggested one way. What I believe very strongly is that we have got to change our trade policies, and we talk about this almost every week. That's NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China. We have another trade agreement coming up with the Pacific Rim. We have a trade agreement coming up with Europe. All of these trade agreements were pushed by corporate America, and their goal was very clear. It was to be able to hire workers in China and other low-wage countries at a fraction of the wages they pay them in the United States, not have to deal with unions, not have to deal with environmental protection. And the corporations have gotten what they wanted. So what you're seeing in virtually every major corporation in America, from General Electric on down, is major downsizing in terms of American workers and significant increases in their workforce abroad. So they are creating jobs. Unfortunately, there are jobs in China and Mexico and all over the world, but not in the United States of America. And the epitome of that philosophy was reflected in a statement by the former CEO of General Electric, Jack Welch. Tom, you may remember what he said. He said, if I had my druthers, I would build our manufacturing plants on barges. Remember him saying that?
Yep.
And by that he meant he would move his manufacturing plants to those parts of the world where wages were the cheapest. Well, can't quite put them on barges yet, but that's what they are doing. And it has been a disaster for the American working class. It is one of the reasons why we have seen the middle class in this country disappear, why many people are working for lower and lower wages, and why the new jobs that are out there are at Walmarts and Burger King rather than earning a decent living at working in a factory. So James put his finger on a major issue. There are different ways to tackle them. I would start with the demand that we change our trade policies and force corporate America to start investing in this country and not just in China.
Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Oh, my pleasure speaking to you today, Senator Sanders. And how you doing, Tom?
Great.
Okay, wonderful. I think I haven't heard it yet. With these calls so far, but to me the biggest elephant in the room was a major factor on economic debt, our education policy, our medical care that we give is the immigration issue. If we don't tackle that, that is going to bring this country down even worse. That is the main, to me, that is the number one issue that has to be addressed. Only because if you have someone here that's not legal here working and is working for less wages, if that person has been here, and been taken away from as far as paying taxes back, and as far as just taking away a job, if that person was able to get, a legal status, then that person will want a regular wage like everyone else, and that would also open up the playing field for people that have been locked out only because they can't compete at $5 or $6 an hour for something that they would do for $10 or $12 an hour.
Good. I think Charles, thank you very much and you make an important point. And let me just very briefly give you my views on the immigration bill that was passed in the Senate, I guess a couple of months ago now, and we will see what ends up happening in the House. I had mixed feelings about the immigration bill. I think there were some features of it that were very positive, and I think Charles identified one of them. Right now in this country, you have millions of undocumented workers who are being exploited. Many of them are working for below minimum wage. They have no rights. They're unable to stand up for their rights. They're not paying taxes. They're not getting Social Security. They're getting ripped off. And the immigration bill would address that important issue. The immigration bill included the DREAM Act, very important for young people born in America, to make sure that they get their rights. My concern, and there were some very good provisions regarding agriculture, dealing with the need for some legal status for many of our agricultural workers. The concern that I had for the bill was that, in fact, it was supported by the big corporations without exception and the big high-tech companies, because it really will be a green light for them, just an open door for them to bring in huge numbers, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of entry-level workers from abroad, from countries around the world, as well as high-tech workers. And I think that that will displace American workers who should be having those jobs. So I was kind of ambivalent about this bill. There were some good things in it, some bad things in it. We managed to get a provision in there, an amendment, which will create 400,000 jobs for young people. And that was one of the reasons I ended up voting yes on it.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour this week, a day early. Bernie's going to be traveling tomorrow on Friday. So if Bernie's with us, he's taking your calls right now, today, here on Thursday, on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't forget Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter. There's a pile of great news there, actually. It's a great news source. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Thursday, but we're doing a special edition of Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls because he's going to be traveling tomorrow. Bernie, you're still with us?
I am right
okay.
here, Tom.
Okay. Sherman in Inglewood, California is on the line. Sherman, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Sherman?
Yes.
Oh, hang on just a second, Sherman. I just pushed the button, and I think it's going to drop you. If it does, my apologies. I let go. Ah, okay. I was able to successfully let go of it. Sherman, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Sherman?
Well, thank you for receiving my call, and let me commend you on your outstanding program.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions.
Please pick one.
Wouldn't it be a good idea to have a certain proportion of the board of directors of large corporations selected by the workers?
The answer is, Sherman, it would be a wonderful idea. Probably not going to happen unless we develop the kind of mass political movement that we need in order to begin to hold some of these very large corporations accountable. What you right have, so the answer is yes, that would be a good idea. What would also be a good idea, and we're making some progress in Vermont in this, and I think in Ohio, a few other states, is moving more to worker ownership of businesses. What you have in America is a lot of individuals who have started businesses. They're getting old. They're retiring. They wouldn't mind leaving it to workers. And we're trying to figure out a way to make that, from a tax point of view, easier. But the idea of having worker cooperatives would be a great thing for this country. But bottom line, how we could have, as Germany does, by the way, if my memory is correct.
Yes.
Having workers on corporate boards so that employees have some say about decision-making certainly would be a good step forward in making us a more democratic nation.
George in Las Vegas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Senator, how you doing?
Good.
What's the sense of the feel that you get in the House and the Senate, or especially in the House, in what direction the country's going to go as far as the elections in 2014? Because apparently the Republicans have already bagged it in. They're just not going to do anything. And then Barack Obama, you know, I guess he's forgotten the fact that he's got the power of the veto, but what direction do you think the country is going to go? Do you think they're going to go back to the center and maybe bring some more Democrats back in or some more moderates? Or are we going to go further and further out into to the different zones, you know, the Tea Party to the right, and obviously the ultra-liberals to the left. And I'll take my answer off the line.
Well, thanks for the question, George. And nobody knows the answer to that, but I'll give you my speculation. And a lot of it really has to do with the role that the president is prepared to play and that Democrats are prepared to play. Because this is what I think, George. I think if you look at where our right-wing Republican friends stand, where our people, the people who run the House of Representatives stand, and some of my colleagues here in the Senate, this is what they believe in. They believe that Social Security should be cut or privatized. They believe that Medicare, as we know it, should be ended, despite the fact that it is a very successful program, voucherized. They believe in massive cuts in Medicaid, in food stamps, in federal aid to education. The vast majority of Republicans in the House do not believe that global warming is real, let alone want to see us do anything about transforming our energy system. In terms of the minimum wage, I mentioned earlier that I believe it's very important that we raise the minimum wage to at least $10 an hour to address the crisis that so many of our low-wage workers are facing. And here's the truth, which many people don't really know, is that most Republicans now, didn't used to be the case, now not only feel that we should not raise the minimum wage, many of them believe that we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage, that that's too much government intrusion into the economy. In other words, if you're living in a high unemployment area and I want to hire you at $3 or $4 an hour and you're prepared to work at that, that's what freedom is about. Your freedom to work for $3 an hour. Now, all of these ideas that I've just expounded, that the Republicans believe in, they reflect what maybe 15, 20% of the American people believe in. In other words, the Republicans are way, way, way out of touch with where America is. And that's just not my view. That's what every single poll says. The polls say the American people want to ask the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes. They want to protect Social Security. The Republicans want to lower taxes for the rich and cut Social Security. Republicans want to increase military spending. Most Americans want to cut military spending. On and on it goes. They're way out of touch. So if the Democrats are prepared to confront the Republicans, if the President of the United States is prepared in a forceful way to stand up to the Republicans, make the contrast clear, and lay out a progressive agenda of raising the minimum wage, creating jobs, asking the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes, and let the Republicans refuse to do that, if that is what unfolds, you know what? I think the Democrats stand a decent chance to regain the House and add to their numbers here in the Senate. But if the American people don't see the difference and they end up saying, well, you know, Democrats are pretty bad and the Republicans are maybe worse, but no one's going to do anything. I hate government. They're all crooks. If that's what ends up filtering down to the average American, who knows what will happen on Election Day. But I think under that scenario, it is likely the Republicans retain control over the House and maybe, possibly, gain control over the Senate.
Mark in San Francisco. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, gentlemen. I have a question. Is there a Democrat or an independent that will stand up against the Republicans on their policies that caused us to have food stamps, to have people unemployed and people on disability because of their wars? They created this situation. I'm tired of them blaming the, you know, everybody's lazy, everybody wants to be on disability when they caused all this. Is there anybody that'll stand up to them?
Well, Mark, I think some of us are doing that and some of us have done that. Some of us have made the point that the Wall Street crash was caused by the greed and recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, and some of us think we should break up these huge financial institutions on Wall Street that have so much wealth and so much power. And some of us think that we have got to end this policy of deregulation and bring back Glass-Steagall. And I would go further by breaking up the banks and real reform to the feds. And some of us think that we should end these disastrous trade policies, which have cost us so many jobs. And in terms of the deficit, what is, I think, maybe Mark referring to is the deficit was caused by two wars that were not paid for, by huge tax breaks to the wealthy. Those are the substantial reasons that we were in a deficit situation. And to get out of that situation, you don't cut programs for working, for people who are hanging in economically, just hanging on by their toenails. What we have to do is create jobs, and the way to do that is to ask the one out of four major corporations that's not paying a nickel in taxes to stop paying their fair share of taxes, to end these huge tax loopholes that exist by companies putting their stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. So to answer your question, Mark, I'm not going to tell you most members are prepared to stand up to the big money interests, but some of us are.
Ashes in Palatine, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. I had a question. Do you know if there's, every high school in America is teaching savings classes to all the juniors and seniors in high school? If I think they did that, every student will get interested in how politics works and how it affects their lives.
Ashes, that is an excellent, you make a very, very good point. And it's not just whether they're teaching civics in high school. The question is whether they're teaching civics, what we used to call civics, in elementary school. And the answer is they're not. And I think we have seen less and less of that in recent years. And the result of that is that many, many young people have not a clue about what democracy is about and how their government works. Interestingly enough, people who go through the immigration process have to learn a lot about the American government, and they're tested on it. But kids who grow up in this country often do not even have an understanding of the basic structure of government, the division of powers in the United States, how people get elected. And I think we have got to place a lot more emphasis on that within our educational system.
Mike in Vail, Arizona. Mike, we just have a minute. A quick one, please.
You bet. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Two champions, both you and Tom, Bernie. Thank you so much. And way to go, San Francisco gentlemen, a couple calls ago. My question is something as obvious as the Medicare Prescription Drug Act and the charging of full retail pricing in order to expand the profits for the pharmaceutical industry. Why is it so difficult to tweak or fix that one singular impactful issue?
Okay, Mike, great question. Tom, how are we doing on time?
I think we got about 15 seconds. So.
All right, I'll start the answer, Mike, and I'll pick it up after the break. The simple answer to your question is the power of the pharmaceutical industry over both the Democratic and Republican parties. Pharmaceutical industry is one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington. They end up charging us the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. And they manage to have great influence in the Affordable Care Act and on many other pieces of legislation.
Okay, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program on Thursday, or a day early. It is 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And don't forget, Bernie's website is sanders.senate.gov, G-O-V. Before the hour, talk media for the rest of us here at the Tom Hartman Program, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, a day early here on Thursday, taking your calls. Bruce in Monroe, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good.
The question that I put forward is, Senator Sanders, how can the minimum wage raise work? I don't believe it can. I just want to tell you why before I take your answers, how you think it can. It's because when minimum wage was $5.15, gasoline was around $1.50, $1.60. They raised minimum wage to $7-something. Now gasoline is $3 because it has no control over the gasoline market and many other things. So if we raise minimum wage to $10, then the gas company and stuff, they're just going to raise gas to negate that. And you're talking about $100 more a week in people's pocket. Average gas tank on a small car is 12, 13 gallons. You raise it $2, that's $25 a week that's going out right there. Then all the stores raise their prices and everything. So all of a sudden, you might be putting an extra $10 or $15 in your pocket if you raise minimum wage, because it's always gone up. And the reason why I say that with our structure, and I'll make this point and then I'll go off, look at the case just today with Castro, and they're going to give him life imprisonment plus 1,000 years. Well, prison is supposed to be for rehabilitation. Well, we're not going to rehab him. So what we're saying is that for the next maybe 30 years, we're going to pay all of his expenses and give him a place to live. Where does that money come from? The taxpayers, from us. Again, they're taking money from us. The government is constantly taking money. The minimum wage, is to me, is a ploy, because every time you raise it, the price and everything in Walmart, Walgreens, Sears, everywhere
okay.
you go.
Okay, Bruce, I think you made your point. Let's hear Bernie's response,
okay.
please.
Thank you, Bruce. You and I have a disagreement on our analysis. I'm not quite sure what the connection is between raising the minimum wage and the outrageous prices that we pay for gas. Let me say a little word. Just reiterate what I said earlier in the program. We have today millions of workers who are working for starvation wages. They work in companies like Walmart's, which are owned by the Walton family. Walmart is the wealthiest family in America, and you got a whole lot of folks who are working for Walmart who make very low wages, who then get Medicaid, they get housing assistance, they get food stamps, precisely because the wealthiest family in the country is not paying them a living wage. That may make sense to you, Bruce. It does not make sense to me. Now, in terms of gas prices, and there's no correlation between raising the minimum wage and gas prices, but gas prices are very, very high today, A, because there is no control. ExxonMobil and these other large oil companies who are enormously profitable can basically charge anything they want. When we were going to elementary school and high school, we were told there was a law called supply and demand. The more supply, less demand, prices go down. Well, you know what? There's a lot of supply out there. Demand has gone down and prices have gone up. They've gone up. And the price reason that oil prices are so high has a lot to do with Wall Street speculation and the oil futures market, et cetera, et cetera. But to answer Bruce's concern, in my view, we should not be having millions of people working for starvation wages. We should raise the minimum wage. Inflation today is reasonably low. Corporate profits are extraordinarily high. And we've got to give a break to the average worker. So I am strongly supportive of raising the minimum wage.
Deborah in Arota, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. My question is about the buyout of family practice physicians in my area by a corporation, and also a well-known state hospital here in my area was recently bought by a corporation. What do you think of that? And also, one more thing. I was shocked to see what was on my history. There are things that are not true. It's very misleading, and that's forever on a computer in Georgia. So be careful what you tell doctors, because you never know what they'll put down that is there forever. That's my question.
Well, Deborah, obviously I'm not going to comment on what's on your medical record, but I share the concern that you have, is that we're seeing a significant growth in corporate medicine. And I'm not a fan of corporate medicine. I believe that at the end of the day, what we want is a healthcare system in this country run on a nonprofit basis, providing high-quality, cost-effective care to our people with a much greater emphasis on disease prevention and primary care than we currently have. But the idea that we have people making billions and billions and billions of dollars off of human sickness, to me, is very, very wrong.
Bernie, we just have 2 minutes left. I noticed Jenny has a question. Instead of putting her on, I'll just ask you. I think it's fairly straightforward. Asking, is lying to Congress illegal regarding some of the things that have been told to Congress by some of the NSA contractors and whatnot? And then, you know, anything else?
If you're under oath, it surely is illegal. That's called perjury, and that's a serious crime.
And your thoughts for the end of the week?
Well, my thoughts for the end of the week is that we are in a strange moment in American history. And I know that a lot of folks out there, especially progressives, are kind of demoralized. They see the severity of the problems facing our country in terms of the economy, in terms of global warming, many other issues out there, and they don't see Congress moving. And what I would just urge those people to understand is the struggle for justice, the struggle for basic human rights, is an ongoing struggle. We're honoring now the 50th anniversary of the great speech by Martin Luther King Jr. In Washington, the I Have a Dream speech. King and his friends and those went before him were fighting for civil rights for decades, and women were fighting for women's rights and gay rights people were fighting for very, very, very long periods of time. And if, in fact, we are legitimately concerned about the crises facing this country, now is not the time to throw up our hands in despair. Now is the time to say, you know, I'm going to get even more involved. I'm going to speak to my friends and my neighbors. I'm going to hold meetings. I'm going to hold elected officials accountable. What we're fighting for is too important to turn our backs on. So with that, I hope everybody has a very nice week.
Senator Sanders, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's always an honor. We will be back here on the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to talk about conservative policies and suicide. Shocking news out of the state of Virginia. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 5 minutes past the hour, 6 minutes past the hour, I guess it is. Tom Hartman here with you, the second hour of our program. Ken Cuccinelli, the governor of Virginia, excuse me, the AG of the attorney general. No, assistant, lieutenant governor of Virginia. Lieutenant. No, attorney general. Yeah, okay. Is running for governor. The governor, of course, Bob McDonald, is in this huge, in the midst of this huge scandal. He's now even blaming his wife, saying that she organized a party, that there was, you know, this it all has to do with this large donor, Star Scientific. The donors, the CEO is Johnny Williams, and he's been passing out money and gifts to these guys like there's no tomorrow, to both McDonald and Cuccinelli. And McDonald yesterday or the day before announced that he was going to give back the Rolex watch, and he was going to give back, he'd be giving back $250,000 or something like that, $125,000, some mind-boggling amount of money that was given to him as a loan. And so, although the First Lady apparently has put some things on the credit card, as it were, that appears to be on the state credit card. Anyhow, it's just a mess in the governor's mansion in Virginia. So the guy, the number two guy in the administration, the Republican administration in Virginia, he's running to fill those shoes, Ken Cuccinelli, and he's having a little bit of a problem. The press went to him today and said, you've gotten gifts from the same guy, haven't you? And he's like, yeah, I have. It's $18,000 worth, actually. And well, actually, the press knew that. I mean, you know, it's in his disclosure forms. So they said, you're going to give it back? And he said, no, I'm not. They're the kind of things you can't give back. So this is interesting. Hunter over at the Daily Kos says, is Cuccinelli talking about sex? This is Ken Cuccinelli we're talking about, you know? So probably not. Oh, wait, he's not. Among the gifts from Williams listed in Cuccinelli's financial disclosure statement is a $1,500 catered Thanksgiving dinner, private jet trips, and vacation lodgings. Cuccinelli says, there's some bells you just can't unring. Well, you could get back the $15,000 or the $18,000. But no, he's invoking what's called the spilt milk defense. You know, as Hunter points out at Daily Kos, you know, it's like saying, well, I'm sorry, Judge. You know, I shot that guy, but he's dead now. We can't undo that. So let's just move on. Right. Speaking of dead and speaking of Virginia, Virginia's suicide rate is now the highest it's been in 13 years. Virginians are now three times more likely to die from suicide than they are from homicide. And Virginia is not alone. You know, over the past 10 years, our nation, actually for much longer than that, but it's really been going up fast since Mr. Bush was president, our nation's suicide rate has been steadily climbing. It's risen a staggering 23% since 2003. According to the CDC, 700,000 emergency room visits just in 2010, the last year for which we have statistics, just for attempted suicides. The fact is, America's suicide rate is on the rise, and conservative economic policies are to blame. And Cuccinelli, of course, wants to perpetuate that in the state of Virginia, where they have one of the worst suicide rates in the country. The brand new study was released in May. Professors David Stuckler and Sanjay Basu of Oxford University in England found that suicide rates both in the United States and the United Kingdom increase when working class wages and wealth, decline. The study calculates, for example, that there were 4,750 suicides during the recession period in the United States, this last recession, compared with suicide rates before the recession. Stuckler and Basu conclude their report by saying, quote, this is from a very good scientific study, quote, what we have learned is that the real danger to public health is not recession per se, but austerity, end of quote. That's right, the very same austerity policies that Republicans in Washington are constantly pushing on us, these are the same policies that are driving Americans to kill themselves. Economic disaster equals despair. Despair very often leads to suicides. And these findings are nothing new. Down under in Australia, they did research that this is a 100-year study, definitely positively shows that suicides increase under conservative governments. Australian scientists found that suicides in that country increased markedly when a conservative government was in power, and they found similar results for the UK. These Australian scientists looked at suicide stats for New South Wales. It's one of the, what we would call a state of Australia, the one that includes Sydney. Between 1901 and when the Australian federal government was established, and 1998, from the beginning of Australia until 98. This was a study that was published in 2003. I've talked about it before here. They then looked at which political parties had control in both state and federal governments in New South Wales, which have consistently been either under Labour Party control, that's like the Democratic Party here in the U.S., or Conservative Party control, that's like the Republican Party here. And surprise, surprise, the scientists found that the highest rates of suicide happened when the conservative state and federal governments were in power. And then here's another smoking gun. When conservative-backed austerity policies began to ravage Greece in 2010, suicide rate went up by 18%. In Athens, the suicide rate soared 25%. Before austerity came to Greece, that nation had the lowest suicide rate in the entire European Union. In other European nations hit with austerity, the results are the same. In Italy, for example, the suicide rate has also increased thanks to devastating austerity policies. So if conservative-backed austerity policies are driving suicides right now, right here in Virginia and in the United States and all around the world, and we've known about this for over a decade, we've seen the science, why is anybody still listening to Reaganomics? Why is anybody paying attention to Republicans and conservatives? And what can we do to reverse this trend? You go back to the study that Stuckler and Basu did. They found that to stop the epidemic of austerity-driven suicides, what should we do? Invest more in our economy and country. They actually went back and looked at how FDR's investments worked out with regard to suicide. And they found that during the Great Depression, every $100 per person of relief spending from FDR's New Deal, that'd be about $1,800 in today's dollars, that's per person, led to a decline in pneumonia deaths of 18 per 100,000 people, a reduction in infant deaths of 18 per 1,000 live births, and a drop in suicides of four per 100,000 people. They also highlight the case of Iceland. In 2008, Iceland experienced arguably the worst banking crisis in history relative to the size of a nation's economy. All three of its major banks failed. Its debt soared, its unemployment rate skyrocketed, the nation's currency completely collapsed. And despite all that, rather than taking the conservative approach that we took in here in the United States, bailing out banks, slashing funding to government programs, cutting social services. Iceland decided to say no to austerity and rejected cuts to its social safety net and rejected bailing out their banksters. And as a result, there was no significant increase in suicides during Iceland's economic collapse. You'd think people would pick this up. You know, you would think that this clear correlation between austerity and suicide rates in Europe and the United States would wake up Republicans and encourage them to stop inflicting the same despicable and devastating policies on Americans. But in their continuing service to the billionaires, Republicans continue to slash away at social safety net programs and continue pushing the very Reaganomics policies that have devastated America's working class. Remember, when Republicans talk about how bad the economy is, they are bragging. Conservative economic policies, from austerity to the sequester to Reaganomics, kill people. And now that the science is in and is irrefutable, it's time to wake Americans up to this deadly con game. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Summer on the Tom Hartman Program on this first day of August. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can drop into our live free chat room. It's great fun over at TomHartman.com. Here's our Geeky Science. Is that our Geeky Science music? It's not. It is? Oh, it is? Okay, cool. It's time for Geeky Science. It's the 3 minutes I get every day that Sean and Louise give me to talk about one of my favorite topics that's not politics, and that's science. Right now, a 12-year-old Arkansas girl, a little girl by the name of Callie Hartig, is clinging to life after she was infected with the rare and extremely deadly brain-eating parasite, Neglaria fowleri, or N. fowleri. F-O-W-L-E-R-I. F-O-W-L as in bird. According to the website The Verge, N. fowleri is, quote, a fatal infection without an effective treatment and one that strikes in a decidedly gruesome manner. An amoebic organism lurking in water is inadvertently inhaled during a swim on a hot summer's day. From there, it travels through the nasal passage and into the brain, where it multiplies, devours one's cerebral fluid and gray matter, and almost invariably causes death. Hartig was playing in a freshwater pool and water park when the parasite is presumed to have entered her body. Not a single human being ever has been known to have survived such an infection in the past decade that we've been tracking them, but currently Hartig is in critical but stable condition. Doctors are also trying out an experimental drug on her that they say may be the key to fighting off this brain-eating parasite and saving her life. And while Hartig's condition is rare, here's the kicker. It may become far more common in the United States in the future. And that's because N. fowleri is one of several organisms that actually benefits from global warming and climate change. Yes, take it up with Jim Inhofe. According to Michael Beach, a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention expert in recreational waterborne illnesses, N. fowleri is a heat-loving amoeba. As water temperatures go up, it does better. In future decades, as temperatures rise, he said, we would expect to see more cases. And as that website, The Verge, noted, quote, in recent years, N. fowleri has popped up in unexpected locations, which some experts suggest is a sign that warmer waters caused by brutal summer heat waves and rising temperatures across the country are catalyzing their spread. The fact that climate change is helping to promote the growth of such a deadly and debilitating condition is pretty damn frightening, and even more proof that we need to be doing more to fight back against global warming, the greatest threat our planet has ever faced, being brought to us today, as we speak, by the Koch brothers, ExxonMobil, BP, and the rest of the dirty fossil fuel industry. So, as I said, anything goes summer. Anna in Guyton, Georgia. Hey, Anna, what's up?
Oh, hello. I would really like if you could pass this question to Bernie Sanders next time we see him, because, you know, I kind of missed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Going around.
Yeah. Let me just stop you right there. I can't do that. You can send a message to Senator Sanders yourself. In fact, he encouraged people to go to his website at sanders.senate.gov and communicate with him. He's in particular looking for stories of people who have dental horror stories, because he's going to go on a big push to promote national dental care. But, I can't pass a question along. If you have a question for me, I'd be glad to take a shot at it. But otherwise, I'd refer you to his website.
Okay. I'd like to ask, if, you know, you're kind of supportive of laws or legislations that promote that cooperatives, democracy in the workplace.
Yeah.
And I guess I might give like a more practical example of that would be I believe Italy has a law like this. Basically, when someone's put on when someone's put on like unemployment, they have an option to look for other people in the same situation, and report that they would like to form a cooperative, and the government would give them all of their employment money at the same time, but only to invest into that company. And the result of this would be, more democracy in the workplace, employment, and, small businesses.
I didn't know that about Italy, and I know that Argentina has been very, very enthusiastically encouraging since 2000, since they told the IMF to go take a hike, has been encouraging worker-owned cooperatives, and there's a lot of them there. I was down there looking at them back in 2001, I think it was. But I think it's a great idea. I would take it a step further. We have this thing called the Small Business Administration that awards hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars a year in low interest loans, and in some cases outright grants to, quote, small businesses. And the problem is that they've defined a small business as anything with fewer than 500 employees, and which I think is crazy. I think a small business should be anything with fewer than 20 employees, or maybe 30 at the most. And I think that small businesses should also be defined as people just starting, somebody who's got a good idea. And if they're, if they're looking for a loan or they're looking for some help and they're looking for $50,000, $100,000, the kind of money that actually can be used to start a small business in America, that's what the Small Business Administration should be doing. And if you get a group of people together, if you get 10 or 15 people together and each one of them can qualify for a $100,000 loan from the Small Business Administration, you get 10 people, you got $1 million. And with $1 million, you can really start a business. And so, yeah, Anna, I'm totally with you. And I think that that's a great idea. And I would strongly encourage that. Thanks for the call. That was a great one. Mark in McHenry, Illinois. Mark, just a minute to the break. It's yours.
Hi, Tom. I've been saying the same thing about suicide rates for some time. Just intuitively that these kinds of policies are going to cause people to die, literally.
Yes.
And on every single issue that I can think of, and I am a progressive, but I have voted as an independent in the past, which has included Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
The current Republican Party to me epitomizes evil. Okay. I see these people as evil. I don't know what has driven them to this point. On every issue of human need, on on health care, women's issues, food assistance, retirement security, every issue that I can think of, they're on the wrong side of, and I can only characterize it as evil.
Well, it's certainly the party of death, unless you are a millionaire, or a billionaire, or a corporation.
Or unless you're a fetus up until the time that you're born,
yes,
they're very pro-life, and at that point you're on your own. And if you starve, oh well, you should have planned better.
Yes, very well said, Mark. Thank you for the call. It's the weird, irony of the modern Republican Party that they call themselves the party of life, and yet they are promoting policies that cause death, aggressively cause death. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more in just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And at some point today, someone is going to receive a free copy, our Shane's favorite caller, of Cracking the Code, my book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Reclaim and Restore America's Original Vision. Okay, here's a totally weird story, speaking of the news of the week. This is incredible. This is The Guardian. The British newspaper, they have a U.S. edition as well, so it's also the American newspaper, The Guardian. Glenn Greenwald writes for the American edition, although it's published all over the world. And a new year, here's the article. In fact, I'll just share the first two sentences with you. and you can scratch your head and figure this one out for yourself. A New York woman says her family's interest in the purchase of pressure cookers and backpacks led to a home visit by six police investigators demanding information about her job, her husband's ancestry, and the preparation of quinoa. Is that how you say it? Quinoa? Q-U-I-N-O-A? Quinoa? Quinoa. Quinoa. Thank you. I've seen it a lot of times. I've eaten it, but I've never said it out loud. Quinoa. Michelle Catalano, who lives in Long Island, New York, said her web searches for pressure cookers, her husband's hunt for backpacks, and her news junkie son's craving for information on the Boston bombings had combined somewhere in the internet ether to create a perfect storm of terrorism profile. Members of what she described as a joint terrorist task force descended on Catalano's home on Wednesday. So when the Guardian contacted the FBI and said, is this you guys? They said, no. They said, and I quote, this is the FBI being quoted by the Guardian, she was visited by Nassau County Police Department. They were working in conjunction with the Suffolk County Police Department. So let me get this right. The local cops are monitoring your internet searches? The Guardian writes, six gentlemen in casual clothes emerged from the vehicles and spread out as they walked toward the house, two toward the backyard on one side, two the other side, one toward the front door. A million things went through my husband's head. None of them were right. He walked outside. This is the wife talking. This is the woman, the mother and wife of the house, however you describe her. He walked outside, and the men greeted him by flashing badges. He could see they all had guns holstered in their waistbands. I felt a sense of dread, creeping dread taking over. What else had I looked up? What kind of searches did I do that alone seemed innocent but put together could make someone suspicious? Were they judging me because my house was a mess? Oh, my God, the Joint Terrorism Task Force is in my house, and there are dirty dishes in my sink? Mostly I felt a great sense of anxiety. This is where we're at, where you have no expectation of privacy. We're trying to learn how to cook some lentils could possibly land you on a terrorist watch list. Or you have to watch every little thing you do because someone else is watching every little thing you do. End of quote. You can read all about it over at theguardian.com. The article is New York Police. Let's see what the headline is. New York woman visited by police after researching pressure cookers online. There's also a story about it over at democraticunderground.com. Put up by Keb Bluey. And good on you, Keb Bluey. That's amazing. That's amazing. Anyhow, as I said, anything goes summer. Cleve in Clayton, Georgia. Hey, Cleve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I just have one question for you. How come the federal government can't take some of the $85 billion a month that they're using to buy treasury bills with and use it to create jobs, rebuilding the infrastructure for the United States?
You mean the Fed?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that the Fed, in fact, I'm quite sure the Fed does not have that legal authority. Only Congress, the Fed is not an official government agency. It's a quasi-government agency. It's a private corporation that has been chartered by the U.S. government. The chairman of the Fed is appointed by the president, but it is owned by its 12 member banks, which are private for-profit banks in the United States, and they in turn are owned by their member banks. Which are all private and generally local for-profit banks. And so the Fed has the power to loan banks into the banking system that it's part of, and apparently an infinite power to do that. It loaned out over $30 trillion during the big Bush crash, and much of it went directly to wealthy individuals, overseas corporations, countries overseas, banks overseas, as well as to the Wall Street banks. But they don't have the ability to spend that money. They can only loan it to the banks. If that money is going to be spent, the banks would have to loan it, and it would have to be loans. If it was going to be spent directly by government, then, according to the Constitution, legislation to authorize the spending has to originate in the House of Representatives, and then from there go to the United States Senate, be passed by the Senate. The bills have to be the same. If they are, then they go to the president for his signature, and then their law, and then the spending commences. But and frankly, it wouldn't be spending. It would be borrowing-driven spending. So really what you're describing is, you know, it would be doing that. We would be borrowing money from the Fed. I think it's wrong that we're borrowing money from the Fed to begin with. The United States has to borrow money on interest. And I think that we should be doing what North Dakota has been doing ever since 1914 or 1918, which is it has its own bank. It can loan itself its own money. So, and they do, and it works. And it's why they have one of the lowest unemployment rates and the best economies in the country. Cleve, thanks for the call. Great topic. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think I know why the Republican Party wants to cut the SNAP program, the food stamp program. Well, number one, the war on drugs is sort of winding down. And number two, immigration from Mexico could slow because Mexico is investing $100 billion to rebuild its infrastructure. So,
but it actually has reversed over the last 3 years. We've actually, for 3 years now, you've seen more people leaving the United States than coming to the United States with regard to Mexico.
Well, I once read an article where an executive from Corrections Corporation of America said that if there were changes in the war on drugs and the end, and changes in illegal immigration, that they would lose their workforce. So I think to guarantee a new and abundant source of corporate slaves to the prisons for profit, that the Republicans are cutting the food stamps. Because when people are hungry, when people have families to feed, they will turn to crime as a last resort. And
then right.
Create a new abundant resource of prisoners.
Yeah, excellent point. I mean, that's exactly what happened in Ireland when the British said, you may not eat that wheat you are exporting to England. You have to eat the potatoes, even though they're rotting from the blight in the 1850s. And so many people were arrested for stealing food, and they what did they do with them? They deported them to Australia, to the prison colony. Excellent point, Harvey. Larry in Nutley, New Jersey. Hey, Larry, what's up?
You were talking about the relationship between suicide and austerity policies.
Yes, sir.
And that makes a lot of sense when you think about some of the groundbreaking studies that were done on suicide. Are you familiar with the work of sociologist Emil Durkheim?
No, I'm not.
All right. Well, basically what he did was he looked at people when they committed suicide, and he found that people who didn't have social ties to other people were the people who were most likely to commit suicide.
Right.
And then he developed out of this a concept that sociologists and other social scientists use called anomie, which is the state of being cut off from other people. And when you're cut off from other people, you lose meaning in your life. Your life doesn't have the meaning that it has, for example, if you're somebody who is connected to other people through church.
Right.
So that's one of the ways that church gives people meaning.
Yes.
In the same way, work gives people meaning, and supporting your family gives people meaning. So the basic message that austerity policies send to people is your life doesn't have any value. It doesn't have any meaning.
Right.
And then it takes you out of the structures that gives your life meaning.
Yeah, I am familiar with that work. I just didn't know the name of the guy who did it, but you're absolutely right, and I think that your analysis is absolutely spot on, Larry. That's absolutely brilliant. And in fact, Shano just said, book to me. So, Larry, would you like a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision?
Sure, great.
Okay, hang on. Let me put you on hold and tell Danielle he is on line 4. And we will send that off to you. You are our book recipient of the day, an autographed copy. Raymond in Shanahan, Illinois. Am I saying it right, Raymond?
Shanahan, close enough.
Okay. So what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, I had a quick question. And I more so just want to pick your brain. I am a progressive, but I make $15 an hour, and I heard recently that quite a few people want to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
No, I don't.
I
don't know if anybody's suggesting that. The president's asking for $9 an hour. Bernie Sanders is suggesting $10.20 an hour, which is where it was in 1968. The $15 an hour that you're talking about is what the McDonald's workers in New York City who are on strike are asking. And these are all people in their late 20s and early 30s, mostly, many of them 40s, 50s, and 60s, who are saying, we are not entry level, you know, we're not students, these are real jobs, we're trying to support families, and we need, you know, we want to work for $15 an hour. And they did the math on this, and they found that the price of a Burger King Whopper or whatever it was, or, you know, the big McDonald's sandwich, then the Burger King sandwich, would go up by 68 cents if those people got that wage increase. Back to you.
But I guess what my point would be is, you know, I've been working since I'm 16. I'm 21 years old now, but I've been working since I was 16. I started off. I worked at a Wendy's for about 3 years. I made it my way up to supervisor position, ended up finding another job in a warehouse, and bumped my pay up about another $2. So I was making about $9.50, $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've worked my way up since then to a supervisor in a warehouse, and I'm making $15 an hour. And, you know, I guess what my whole thing would be, and I see what you're saying now, not everybody's saying $15 an hour, but I guess my whole point would be, you know, I'm skilled. I have, you know, certifications on a forklift, scissor lift. I do shipping, receiving invoices. I, you know, have a C-class license.
Right.
I worked my way up to the where I'm at. I just don't understand why people think that, you know, it's
well, I think most of these people who are working at McDonald's have worked there for a long, long time. Raymond, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We'll have to carry on this conversation another
You're
time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I'm sorry I took you so late in the break, Raymond. That was a good question, and please call back next week, and let's get into it a little deeper. We'll be right back. Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception, Tom Hartman here with you, and John in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, John, what's up? Thanks for listening to KABQ.
I'm calling about the McBudget.
The McBudget? Perfect.
McBudget. I spend $400 a month on health insurance and $40 to $50 a month on dental insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So can you maybe tell me someone at McDonald's I can talk to about that $25 a month health insurance they offer their employees?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think
it's in the budget.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the McDonald's budget that they posted online where they said for their employees, here's an example of how to do your household budget.
Right, and you can get health insurance for $25 a month.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It is very bizarre. Okay, John, thanks a lot for the call. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you help. This, of course, in South Sudan, where Ellen goes 3-4 times a year. And Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you. A lot of on Snowden today. In fact, I would say a good portion of the White House presser was taken on Snowden. Senator Graham said the Russian government could not be more provocative and is a sign of Vladimir Putin's clear lack of respect for President Obama. Who's to think that Graham...
Wait a minute, Lindsey Graham tried to make this partisan?
It's quite astounding. The White House wasn't so good either on it, and in fact talked about the fact... Well, first of all, Steny Hoyer said that relations between the U.S. and Russia are not on a positive track, but he didn't mean it sort of anti-Snowden. I secretly think that he doesn't think Snowden is the worst thing in the world. But the White House certainly launched into the fact that they're going to evaluate this summit that's supposed to take place between the two countries, and that they didn't notify that there's been public channels and back channels, and they went on and on and on.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because somebody then asked the press secretary, well, you know, if this hadn't been brought out by Snowden, none of these discussions would be happening. The president is actually meeting with some pro and con people this afternoon to talk about actually the Patriot Act, two particular areas of the Patriot Act, they're going to be talking about Section 215 and Section 702. And he said, well, there are, you know, whistleblower ways to go. But my brother Michael has actually done a lot of work on this whistleblowers. And also what Ron Wyden had said, who's, by the way, one of the people meeting with the president today, he said, you know, even if a whistleblower had come to them and said all this, because they're on the Intelligence Committee and they've sworn to not talk about it, they couldn't talk about it again, even if a whistleblower came to them.
Right. Right. So it's a catch-22.
It's totally catch-22.
Yeah. And it looks to me, I mean, why are these people lying to Congress and to the American people? It almost looks like there's a criminal enterprise being run out of the executive branch of this government.
Well, an enterprising reporter actually had asked that on the Hill today about being lied to. It wasn't at the White House presser.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was at Hoyer's. But why why Congress has been lied to time and time again.
And what was the answer he got?
Well, you know, there wasn't an answer. It was
quiet, a non-answer. Yeah.
It was, well, you know, we discussed these things and intelligence, you know, all that kind of.
Yeah. Quack, quack, quack. Yeah, got it.
Okay. On Obamacare, you know, they're taking their 40th vote on getting rid of Obamacare. The Tea Party held an outside demonstration out of the Capitol today. Senator Ted Cruz showed up and to talk about how they're going to defund Obamacare. Also, a group of liberal America's United for Change had a conference call with journalists to talk about how they're going to go on the offensive on Obamacare. Now, tomorrow, as you know, Tom, is the last day that everybody is in session until after Labor Day, actually until after, I think, the first Jewish holiday. So they come back, I think, on the 9th, and they each have their talking points. The Republicans are going with...
They come back on September 9th, right?
September 9th.
Right,
did I say
okay.
October? I'm sorry.
No,
September.
You didn't. You didn't say anything, and that's why I was asking.
Okay, September 9th. Okay. So the Republicans are going with this cost of government and the fact that they want to make sure that people know about the cost of government and reducing the size and cost of government and how they want to stop any regulation that's going to have more than $1 billion impact on the economy issued by any of the administration. So that's sort of they're calling it the Stop Government Abuse Act.
Right.
The Democrats have their own message when they go on recess, and they're talking about the Make It in America bill, and they're trying to go on sort of three big things, well, four actually, manufacturing, U.S. exports, bring jobs back to America with incentives, and invest in training and 21st century workforce investments.
And I'm guessing that most Americans would really prefer what the Democrats are talking about, but the Republicans, is it that they're tone deaf, that they're bought off, or that they represent, that enough of them represent such heavily redistricted, gerrymandered districts that are so Tea Party-ish that they really have no choice but to act like this?
Yeah, I call it the gerrymandered Tea Party.
Yeah.
And that is what's happening. They don't care as long as they can say, hey, I've said this on the floor. I'm fighting the good fight.
Right. Don't primary me.
Don't primary
right.
me. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think you should write an article called that.
Yeah, well, that's a great song for Jim Tura to write and perform. You know, he'd do it to the tune of Don't Bogart That Joint, My Friend. You know. Anyway, yes.
Okay, some more information today. It looks like Senate Bill 1233 went down. That is the transportation bill along with the HUD bill. There was absolutely what's called no cloture. They needed 60 votes. They got 54 to 43. Only Senator Collins, who's been working very heavily on the transportation bill, voted with the Democrats.
Amazing. Thank you, Ellen. And Ellen, just a quick point, just FYI, you don't need to respond, but I left that galley in your office today.
Great. So, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ellen. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, amazing stuff going on with Google. You know, do no evil? Yes, Google. The campaign manager for Forecast the Facts, forecastthefacts.org, Brad Johnson, is on the line with us. Hey, Brad, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. So tell us what is happening with regard to Google and their Do No Evil and Senator Inhofe.
Google started to give political contributions for global warming deniers, both organizations and politicians. And just in a few weeks ago, they held a big dollar fundraiser for Senator Inhofe at their Washington D.C. headquarters.
Mm-hmm. So why would Google be giving money to James Inhofe and to climate change denying organizations like the Competitive Enterprise Institute?
It's a really good question, actually. There have been a few anonymous statements, and they've kind of from Google spokespeople who have said something like, well, we disagree with Inhofe on climate policy, but we agree with him on other issues, and we have a data center in Oklahoma, so that's why we're giving him money.
Might the answer actually be much more simple than that? And that is that the best that it, you know, Jim Inhofe is almost certainly going to get reelected every time he runs. He's you know, he's got a pile of money, bigger, you know, he's got basically, you know, the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and everybody else behind him. It's going to be very hard to beat him. And the best investment you can make in America right now, the one that typically returns well over 1,000%, sometimes over 100,000% return on investment, is to buy a politician. And so Google is just doing what every other multinational corporation in America is doing.
Well, I think there's one thing that, I mean, I'm a little disappointed you that you would promote that kind of political cynicism, but it's also
it's
kind
fact.
Of... Well,
I'm not being cynical.
It's actually, and I can give you. It's something that's actually something that kind of, if you decide that that's true and unchangeable, that's what.
No, I don't think it's unchangeable. It's the reason why, you know, at least three or four times a week, I do shows about how people need to go to movetoamend.org and amend the Constitution to roll back the Supreme Court's doctrine that money is the same thing as free speech,
right,
and that corporations are the same thing as people. I think it's
right.
Very changeable. But as long as that Supreme Court created doctrine, which was never promoted by any Congress or legislature in the history of America and never promoted by any executive, by any president, as long as that doctrine is the law of the land in the United States, with a very few exceptions, people like Bernie Sanders or Jan Schakowsky or, you know, Sherrod Brown, people who are in small enough states where they can do retail politics or are well known enough that, you know, in their districts that they have a lot of support. With very few exceptions, you've got a lot of politicians in Washington, D.C. who are just, you know, they're bought out.
Well, I mean, I think that's not exactly what political scientists would say is the process, but a more specific way of looking at it is, as you pointed out, Inhofe already has enough money from the oil and gas industry. And so it doesn't really make sense that, you know, there's basically no amount of money that Google can give to Inhofe if the goal is to buy him off.
Well, but I think the goal is to prevent a meeting.
I mean, Google doesn't need to give Inhofe like a few thousand dollars or $10,000 to get a meeting with them. They're one of the largest multinational corporations in the world, and it's holding a fundraiser for Inhofe is not just cynical politics; it's also stupid politics. All it does is it's lending Google's brand to Inhofe, and lending Inhofe's brand to Google, and that's the whole thing, is that it tarnishes Google's reputation, which actually matters, because it's not just a PR issue for them. They have their tens of thousands of employees at Google are by and large overwhelming progressive, and moreover actually care about science and climate change.
Yes.
And that's the real thing, is that if you just want to look at this from a totally cynical bottom line perspective, Google's long-term interests are in having the world and having the American people actually believe in science and not believe that global warming is a scientific conspiracy. Mm-hmm. It's actually in their interests not to promote the destruction of our biosphere by the fossil fuel industry. And their Google's corporate interests are not aligned with Inhofe's on lots of other issues. The way I look at it is I'm most likely, I think they're being snookered by their top corporate lobbyist, Susan Molinari, who's a Republican corporate lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Google has kind of more money than they know what to do with, and they're naive about Washington, D.C. politics. And part of that, and, you know, they believe that the cynicism of kind of what you're saying, and instead of recognizing that they're sitting on kind of the biggest database, kind of known to man,
mm-hmm.
and using that knowledge to to find a better pathway. It might be a little more difficult, but it's kind of like, it's actually the same rhetoric that they're using with their releasing their new Moto X phone today. Mm-hmm. And Google CEO Eric Schmidt said that, you know, they could have taken the cheaper and easier path of having it be, you know, built and assembled outside the United States, but they made sure to actually invest in, you know, factories here in the United States. I mean, and it's certainly not a perfect thing. You know, a lot of the work is obviously being done outside the United States, but they're making some investments because they at least so far as we can tell, actually are a company that tries to have, you know, their ethical values aligned with of their employees and of their leadership actually align with their business practices. And this is a clear mistake where they fail to do that.
Well, and you're doing a great job of pointing that out. And in fact, tonight, I understand in New York City, they're rolling out this new phone. And we're talking with Brad Johnson, the campaigns manager for ForecastTheFacts.org, that tonight you folks are going to be there?
Yeah, that's right. And any of your listeners who are in the New York area are totally welcome to come down to the waterfront, 11th Avenue between 27th and 28th, and we'll be out there protesting. We have the Occupy Wall Street Light Brigade. We'll have signs. Darth Vader will be holding a counter protest promoting, encouraging Google to fund more evil. And so it should be a good time, you know, and friendly. And I think that's the real, and you know, I'm pretty sure that no one at the party, you know, wants to be part of, you know, supporting a company that's funding homophobia and climate denial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's the whole thing. It's just that this is, it's so clearly a mistake of judgment by Google's corporate leadership that, you know, it shouldn't be that hard. You know, if, you know, it might not be the easiest thing to do to work with our political system and find a way to engage with it that doesn't require, you know, the cheapest and most corrupt form of politics. And it's really hard for, say, an individual voter. But say you're a multi-billion-dollar company, like you have a little more leverage than the average citizen to figure out a better way of working, and not just that, like not just working with this system, but actually improving and strengthening it.
Yeah, the main thing that you said that boggled my mind is that Susan Molinari is in charge of their money. I mean, she has been such a corporate shill for the Republican Party for so long.
That's right.
That's
the logic is that. And you saw this with kind of the Facebook and the whole forward.us effort, where you're seeing these Silicon Valley companies recognizing that they need to engage with our American political system.
Yeah, and bumbling about, apparently.
Yeah.
Brad
exactly.
Johnson, good on you for keeping them honest, but it's more like just waking them up. And let's hope your efforts are successful. People can learn all about it at forecastthefacts.org. And Brad, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. And if you are in New York City tonight, get thee down to the Lower West Side. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. The Patriot Act. There's a lot of provisions. I'm curious about provision 584. And provision 4128. I mean, you know, there's some pretty strange stuff. In any case, Virginia's shockingly high suicide rate points to a national problem. We talked about that earlier today, didn't we? GM. Oh, this is incredible news. General Motors today, now, officially, J.D. Power and Associates, you know, they determined the best car sold in the United States. Best car sold in the United States is made by GM. In fact, all four of GM's brands ranked above average, led by their GMC truck brand, and which trailed only Volkswagen AG's Porsche sports car line. And this is just quite remarkable. The quote from the guy, he says, from David Sargent, he's the J.D. Power Vice President of Global Vehicle Research. He said, if you were to ask me the question, which corporation has the best quality in the entire industry, the answer would be General Motors. good cars. I when I travel a lot, I rent cars, and the company that I rent from almost always gives me a GM car, and I've just really been amazed over the years. I've been, renting for several decades to see the GM cars get worse and then now get better, and they're so much better now. It's really quite remarkable. It really is. Anyhow, Robert in Joliet, Illinois. Hey, Robert.
How you doing, Tom?
Great.
I wanted to rebuttal the gentleman from Shanahan. I guess it seemed like he was saying that the food workers are worse. Going on strike to demand a higher wage. Kind of sounded like he felt that they didn't really deserve a higher wage in general, just based on their low skill level, according to him.
Right.
And I would say that, that's where it starts. It starts at the bargaining table. You work your way high to get to a reasonable amount. That's how unions started. I know I'm a union member. And, I feel like as if they ask for a higher wage, it'll just follow along in the market, and then everybody else's wage will go higher, because then now companies have to compete with the other companies to keep their workers. And I just feel like it'll be a domino effect, and it'll just affect everybody in a positive way.
Yes.
I don't think he saw that.
I agree. What I would say to that fellow, and it's unfortunate that we ran out of time, although he was taking a while to get to his point. But still, what I would say to him is that if he's only making $15 an hour after all these years and all these certifications, there's something wrong with our system in this country. He's worth more than that. And
I don't think he's seeing that point either. He's not seeing that he should be demanding for a higher wage based on the fact of his skills and his qualifications. That
right. He's got Stockholm syndrome.
Worker. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Robert, thanks for the call. Well said. Doug in St. Peter's, Missouri. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Tom, love your show. Love talking to you.
Thank you.
I've got an idea that's been percolating around in my head for a while. And I drive a Chevy Cruze. It's a great car.
Mm-hmm.
That what we need to do is to have a senator insert into one of the bills that go through the Senate, for the final vote, a clause in there that says that no state shall take more from the federal government than it puts in.
Good luck with that. You're every red state in the country is suddenly toast.
Exactly. Well, it's their own philosophy. They say, quote, don't borrow money, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, da-da-da, and we all know that's
right.
Bogus.
Yeah, Chris Christie really pointed that out the other day when he went after Rand Paul, and Rand Paul said that Chris Christie was a porker. I think it was a bad attempt to make light of Chris Christie's weight. And Chris Christie was like, sorry, buddy, but, your state gets $1.60 or something like that for every dollar that they send to D.C., and New Jersey only gets 65 cents for every dollar we send to D.C. So we're a donor state, you're a taker state, stop. And at that point, Rand Paul says, maybe we should stop having this debate. It's not good for Republicans to squabble like this. I mean, Chris Christie was just kicking his butt.
Oh, he caved on it, no doubt.
Yeah.
But I'm saying do like Roy Blunt did. Stick it in something, then watch the fireworks.
Right, like Roy Blunt did with the postal thing, blowing up the postal service.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, Doug. I think that's a great suggestion. You would hear screams from all the red states because they are the taker states and the blue states are the donor states. And it's a huge reality and one that the Republicans don't like you to know about. Jay in Oswego. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, Jay here. How you doing? Hey, a little snippet earlier you had mentioned, it just got me thinking about the 68 cents on, I think it was the Burger King burger.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one point I want to make, two points I'm going to make. The first point. Interesting, the response. I'm guessing they deferred all costs down the line. These are all new expenses, and nothing's been absorbed by the bloated top tier of C-level executives. It was just basically, oh, well, we'll charge more to pay that.
Right. The 68 cents assumes that all the executives are still making the huge amounts of money that they're making. Yes.
Right. So, and then the conversation really begins at this point, doesn't it? Where we say, oh, so what you mean is you'll only do it if you do some case study that shows that people will pay the 68 cents more a burger. Otherwise, you're hanging on to for dear life every dollar and screw all those other people. I mean, that's basically the problem in America right now, right?
It is. It very much is. And that goes back to the Reagan tax cuts, because back when you could make your first $3 million and pay less than 50%, and after that it went all the way up to 74%, people would take $1 million or $2 million or $3 million a year in today's dollars as pay and then stop, because why pay 74%? And that's why the average CEO, when Reagan came into office, was paid 30 times what the average worker was. And now you've got, you know, CEOs being paid 500 times what workers are, uniquely in the United States. It's not the case in Europe, and it's because of the Reagan tax cuts.
So here's where the wool's been pulled over America's eyes, that, and it's the I guess almost the Joe the Plumber scenario, right? Like, well, if you suck up and do the right things, you could be that guy too.
Right.
So that you'll get us to defend that somehow, not look at the ratio and say, well, you know what, this should be like the Industrial Revolution.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Jay, what Reagan did was basically said, I'm declaring the lottery economy. The American dream is now that I'm going to hit the jackpot. I'm going to win the lottery. I'm going to become a CEO, and I'm going to make $100 million a year. And you're right. For some reason, some of these guys in the red states, they think, you know, we got to protect them billionaires because I might be one day. I'm sorry, you're not going to be. Thank you, Jay.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
All right, interesting headline over at Media Matters. Fox fabricates Jay Carney quote. Surprise? Nah. The good, the bad, and the very, very epithematically ugly, the good. Bianca Jagger, the actress-turned-activist, is throwing her support behind anti-fracking protests in Balcombe, England. Check out what she said in a video she released to rally others to the cause.
People will try to convince you that hydraulic fracking is going to be good for the country, that is going to bring jobs, that is going to make the price of fossil fuel cheaper. Don't be fooled by them. This is not a panacea. The harm that it will cause to the environment, the harm that it will cause to our water sources, the damage that it will cause to this beautiful area of Balcombe, they're fooling you. And you need to know the truth.
Bianca's spot on. Fracking is not a solution to the energy problems of the United Kingdom or any other country, for that matter. It contaminates drinking water and puts the health of all surrounding communities at risk. Let's hope the rest of the people of Balcombe join with Ms. Jagger to just say no to hydraulic fracturing. The bad. George Zimmerman, America's most notorious neighborhood watchman, was pulled over for speeding in Forney, Texas this weekend. While his traffic stop isn't news in itself, what is news is that Zimmerman was armed when a highway patrolman stopped him. He had a gun stored cozy and tight in his glove compartment. Zimmerman passed the cop's background check and was allowed to drive away without any more than a warning for speeding. But let's be honest, is there anybody out there who feels comfortable with him driving around the country with a handgun at his side? And the very, very ugly, Neil Cavuto. Fox business host has something to say to all those greedy workers and demagogue Democrats demanding higher wages. Check this out.
But this constant dismissive attitude on jobs has really got me a goat now. It's like jobs aren't enough these days. They damn well better pay well, or folks just really aren't going to apply for them at all. Did I ever tell you when I was a kid, you'd be grateful for any job you could find? Now a lot of kids are just the opposite, turning up their noses at fast food jobs that go begging at $11 an hour. It's true. Only in America can our politicians bemoan a livable wage, forgetting a lot of folks would be grateful for any wage, any chance, any job, any time.
I know it's really hard for a multimillionaire pundit like Neil to sit on his high horse lecturing all the peons about the virtues of hard work, but in reality, $11 an hour only translates into about $22,000 a year, which is not an easy salary to live on. That Neil Cavuto can so callously dismiss the desire of millions of Americans to want a job that actually pays the bills is just very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. Wayne in Jacksonville, Illinois. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Yes. It might seem like a long time ago, but it seems like time to make some noise about Larry Summers' part in the Brooksley Bourne affair of the late 90s. And I'm hoping that you...
I have not heard that name in a long, long time. Please refresh my memory. This was during the Clinton administration.
She was during Clinton's second term. She was the head of the Commodities Future Trading Commission.
Right.
And she tried to get a handle on over-the-counter derivatives, saying that there was a tragedy brewing there. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, it was Alan Greenspan and Larry Summers who pretty much bulldozed her out of Washington.
Hmm. That's right. That's that. And, that comports with my recollection too. Although, like I said, it's been a long time since I visited that. I think Larry Summers has far more recent.
Yes, but this one goes to the very root of everything. It seems to me like.
Yeah.
And the things that I hear as objections to him, really, I you know that one stacks up as much as anything, and I think that.
Yeah.
It should be a liberal talking point right now.
I think you're absolutely right. Wayne, thank you for calling and sharing that. I'm going to have to do some archival digging on that one. Appreciate the call. Daryl in Buna, Texas. Am I saying that right, Daryl?
Yes. Tom, what I'd like to say is I wish you would tell the people about Obamacare. A lot of the older people are scared that the prices go they're medical bills, their
right.
insurance prices go up because they think it because Republicans are telling them this.
Right. But the prices are
and
actually going to go down.
Because they don't know what a pool means. They don't know understand a lot of older people don't understand the larger the pool, that's what brings things down.
That's correct.
Any kind of pool. Like y'all were talking earlier about, what was it, banks or some kind of bank or loan company?
Mm-hmm.
Pool together. People pool themselves together and form these organizations and stuff.
Yep.
And yep. That would help a lot.
You're absolutely right, Daryl. And first of all, if somebody's over 65 and they're on Medicare, you know, this is not going to affect them at all. But in addition to that, it's not going to drive up. Not only is it not going to drive up Medicare costs, but because it's driving down costs throughout the healthcare system in general, it's probably going to reduce even the out-of-pocket costs that people on Medicare have over time. And particularly as states start experimenting with, you know, going a step beyond this. I mean, if like Vermont, you know, is going single payer presumably in 2016, maybe 2014. So that's all good stuff. And, you know, over the short term, it's also going to be very helpful. I'm surprised that a Republican would try to scare an older person by saying that their health care costs are going to go up under Obamacare. How could they get away with that?
Well, you see the bald-faced lies they tell right on TV. all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're
on
right.
TV talking the other night about Obamacare and they're going to defund it and all that.
Yeah.
Bald-faced lies, and yet people believe that because they're scared. They're scaring them. That's what they're doing.
Well, if the Republicans defund Obamacare, the cost of health care will go up. I mean, if the Republicans succeed and do away with the law that says that health insurance companies have to spend, you know, they can't skim more than 20% off the top, for example, that health insurance companies can't tell you that you can't get health insurance from them any longer or Medicare, you know, co-policies or anything else if you have a pre-existing condition. I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, Obamacare has been the law of the land for three years now, I believe, in that neighborhood. And it has already produced a lot of changes in our healthcare system, all for the better, all have driven down costs, all have empowered consumers. And yeah, you're right, Daryl. It's just bald-faced lies. So I think between you and me, I think we just did it. Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Oh, and you might pass along to your previous caller that insurance costs have gone down. Health insurance costs have gone down in California and New York already.
Yeah, yeah. In some cases, by as much as 50%.
Obamacare costs are going down.
Yes.
So, Tom, yep. I have an idea for a constitutional challenge on same-sex marriage that would force the issue to be marriage equality be accepted nationwide, and here's what it would be. I have emailed a couple of legislators here in Washington and trying to get the idea forward that Washington state should not accept, honor the marriages of any state, heterosexual marriages of any state that does not reciprocate and honor the marriages from Washington state. And the reason this is because it's not only discriminating against the same-sex couples from Washington state, but it's discriminating against Washingtonians in general, because we passed that law.
Right.
So it's, you know, in essence, that's our privileges and immunities from our state. And if they don't honor it, then we shouldn't. Now, what this would do, of course, that would be unconstitutional under Article 4, Section 1, the very first sentence,
mm-hmm.
that says that all states will honor privileges and immunities of the other states. So if it were challenged by a state that did not, in other words, if they challenge it, if they win, they lose.
Right. That's an interesting theory. That's an interesting theory. Paul, thanks for calling and sharing that. Let me roll that around in my head for a little while. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hi. I was Brooksley Gore. I've been writing about it, too, because Summers, Geithner, and Greenspan, it was on Frontline. They were this whole episode was pretty well explained. She had had their prior experience with these derivatives and started warning. And her when she did this, she was shot down by Summers. And I don't know how much of his, but there was the three of them. Geithner.
What was his job at that time? Was he was like a senior economic advisor to Bill Clinton?
Advisor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so. He's an advisor. And they actually what they said was that they changed the law for her federal agency, so it could not, she and her agency could not intervene.
Yeah, wasn't that part of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act?
Well, you're more than I know.
Okay. I'm pretty sure it was. And that was passed in either 99 or 2000. It was pushed by Phil Graham.
Yeah. So he wasn't passive. He was aggressive about taking her down, and she should be nominated for the position instead of Summers because she was on top of it 3 years, I think, before it all fell apart. Frontline mm-hmm. had a hour-long program.
Is she still out there? Is she still employed and working in the field, or has she retired now?
What she's doing. I don't know. She was like top of her class at Yale, I think it was. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, she was one smart woman.
Yeah, well, she was certainly smarter than the three of them, and they actually conspired to put her under, her and her agency under, and take it out of the way of the regulations that brought us down. So now, I mean, not exactly what I would think something would recommend him.
She was sort of that generation's Elizabeth Warren. Richard, excellent point. Thank you for validating that. Thanks for the call and for listening to WCPT. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So this is interesting. There's the Broward Bulldog. A local newspaper did a FOIA filing and found that the Bush administration lied to us about the Saudi connection to 9/11. Fair and only slightly unbalanced Tom Hartman here with you and Steve in North Troy, Vermont. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Greetings from the home of the Northern Lights.
Thank you.
Yeah, these consultants, it reminds me of when Hill and Knowlton were paying Ahmad Chalabi in the Iraqi National Congress to, keep that thing afloat.
Yeah.
But anyways, the reason why I called, we brought up Brooksley Bourne. Remember a while ago we talked about the Fed not counting M3, the total money in circulation,
mm-hmm.
A long time ago?
Yes.
And neither of us could, come up with a reason why the Fed would stop counting M3?
Yes.
Hello, Tom?
Yeah, I'm here. And yes, I remember that conversation.
Well, I can't hear you. If you can hear me anyway.
You can't.
The reason they stopped counting M3, I heard this from the Web of Debt professor, Sheila, mm-hmm. I can't remember her last name, but the reason they stopped counting M3 was exactly because of the derivative.
Uh-huh.
And they've gotten so out of control.
Oh, because there's hundreds of trillions of dollars of derivatives, which is arguably part of the money supply, and that would mean that the money supply has exploded over the last decade and a half.
See you on the next time.
Yeah, okay. Steve, you can't hear me, but anyhow, I got what you said, and the penny fell for me. Thank you for that. June in Shawano, Wisconsin. Hey, June, what's up?
Hi, I'm calling about Bradley Manning and the terrible job that corporate media has done
mm-hmm.
following his case.
Yeah.
And the terrible job that the military has done in making it easy for, harder for those who are involved in following his case.
Mm-hmm.
Having to go outside to speak to someone and no efforts being made to help him out.
Well, I think there's a fair amount of butt covering going on. You know, this started during the Bush administration. He was arrested. He was tortured. I mean, terrible things happened to this young man.
Yes. And I'd like to also say, who's speaking for Bradley Manning? And I was worried because John Stewart is away. And last night, Colbert did a lovely job.
Oh, good. I will have to.
He said, what is all of these espionage charges and who is this man spying for? And then he said he must be spying for the American people.
Yep.
We're the ones he's protecting, said Colbert.
Which is absolutely right. June, thank you for calling and making that point. And a tip of the hat to Stephen Colbert, if that's what you said, Stephen. Michael in Victor, Montana. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I heard the first-time caller, long-time listener. Mm-hmm. We enjoy your program. We record it every day. The thing about Brooks Lyborn, PBS mm-hmm. did a very good program on it a number of years ago.
Yeah, a fellow called earlier said it was on Frontline.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I hope I
remember watching that. That was like that was like a decade ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. There were three people, Summers, Greenspan, and Robert Rubin were involved in that. Okay. They also talked to Alan Levitt, Arthur Levitt, who was at SEC, to go in with them.
Mm-hmm.
I understand he was upset about that later. Mm. Then they got Phil Graham and Jim Leach of Iowa, the representative, to push the legislation through Congress.
So that was the Commodity Futures Modernization Act?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's my recollection. Michael, thanks for the confirmation, and I'll get on it. I need to print out some details of that so I can riff on it. Deborah in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hey, Deborah. Deborah? Hi, you are on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm great. Not in Massachusetts, but that's fine. I'm from District 12, and Greens. We have a lot of natural resources here in Appalachia. I'm in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And your callers really take my breath away. And all I want to say to them is, can we have our mountains back?
Mm.
Please don't call us takers.
Yeah.
Please don't assume that your voting machines don't work, but ours do.
Right.
Please don't do that. Please don't make this divide among people.
That's a very good point. Earlier when I pointed out that Rand Paul and Chris Christie were fighting with each other, and Chris Christie said, you know, we get 65 cents back for every dollar we send to the federal government, and Rand Paul's state, your state, Tennessee, or is it Kentucky, gets back $1.60. You're right. There are good people in every state, and the kind of cavalier attitude, which I know I've exhibited sometimes, of, oh, yeah, let's just write everybody in the state off, is wrong. Deborah, thank you for correcting me.
Well, I don't think that the people here are prime. I can tell you that a recent candidate, after the election, his sister stopped me and said, you know, he has to run as a Democrat because you can't get elected as a Republican here. You know, we don't control our machines.
Right. Yeah.
Any more than you do.
I get it, Deborah. I get it. Thank you very much. Lori, in Wrightwood, California. Lori, we got a minute to the end of the show, and it's yours.
Oh, hi, Tom. I have been following the Bradley Manning case, too, and I want to know why none of the media has ever mentioned who the pilot was that shot those.
I don't think the pilots have ever been identified, have they?
And I don't know. And why hasn't anyone looked into it? And remember Lieutenant Kelly in Vietnam?
Yeah.
That was, you know, he was sent to jail for what he did. And I think that pilot was a murderer.
Well, and the pilot was acting on orders. So, I mean, because you could hear that chatter in the cockpit. I'm not saying the pilot wasn't a murderer, but I'm saying there are other people who are participating as well, and they should all be held to account. Nobody told Callie, to the best of my knowledge, to do what he did. But that pilot You know, I think that there are multiple people involved in this who should be brought to account. I'm with you, Lori. I'm with you. Thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman John Conyers is going to drop by on his efforts to rein in the NSA. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. What's on your mind this week? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really does require you. You got to get out there and get active. Show up. Occupy something. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.